that you're going to show up in church some Sunday and something totally unexpected is going to happen. And for the first time in my 80 years, it's happened here today. There is absolutely no need for me to preach a sermon this morning. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day. Now, if you think somebody who has been a minister as long as I have, including far too many years as an active politician, can resist the opportunity to say anything, you have got to be dreaming big time. We have had an incredible morning here this morning. And I'm going to have to restrain myself because I didn't think that we could be in church together and hear and participate in so much that speaks to us of the truth and promise of reconciliation. The drumming, the singing from Carolyn and Walking Wolf has opened up for us vistas of hope and understanding which almost none of us would have believed possible, and particularly myself. I suppose the main reason I'm here is that I'm a bit of a connector. When Walking Wolf talks about the need for allies, then I think that's likely why I'm here, as an ally. Because here's the problem in a nutshell. We have been separated so much apart for the last number of centuries that we are trying to bridge in one lifetime this enormous gap and break, which has created such pain for the original peoples of this land. And we are only gradually becoming aware of the fact that this is not just their pain. It is our pain too, because we have not been passive to what has happened. And we are not even being passive today when we hear of the experiences of people who still suffer from the impact of Indian residential schools. Now, if you had invited me to speak here 20, 30, or 40 years ago, actually one of your former ministers, Frank Meadows, some of you may remember Frank, was a good friend of mine more than half a century ago. And if Frank or somebody had invited me here to speak in this church about Indian residential schools, surely almost everybody would put up their hands and say, why? What's that all about? You know, the hidden aspect of the involvement of Canada and the leading Canadian churches in the initiative and maintenance of Indian residential schools for longer than Canada has existed is still to me at this ripe old age a shock. Because the more that we begin to understand what that was all about, the immediate question comes to me, how did that happen? I won't mention who said this to me recently, but he is one of Canada's most well-known Canadians. When he came to me after we had a discussion about residential schools and looked at me and said, how did that happen? How did that happen? This year, Canada is going to celebrate its 150th birthday, right? From its founding in 1867. And I remember 1967, which is only 50 years ago, when we had a glorious celebration all over the country. You remember Bobby Jimmy singing that song? Canada, you know? And all of the things that went on at Expo 67 in Montreal and everything else that was this sort of great welling up of patriotism and pride and all the things that we felt so good about in terms of Canada. And yet, in 1967, there were tens, 50, 60, 70, 80 Indian residential schools all over this country. All over this country. Fast forward from 1967 to the early 1990s, and a chief that perhaps nobody had ever heard of before in Manitoba said on CBC television, "I want to tell you what happened in the two residential schools that I was in Manitoba. I was beaten, I was sexually abused, I was humiliated, I was told my language was not to be spoken, and I was to forget that I was a Cree in Manitoba." How did that happen? Why did it happen? Go back to 1867. And one of the first laws that was passed after Canada declared itself a country, a new nation, a dominion, within the first decade of its very existence, we had the Indian Act. And why and what was the Indian Act? It was to gradually relocate, suppress, and otherwise humiliate those who were the First Nations of this land. And as if that was not enough, a few years later we had the founding of Indian residential schools on the part of the Government of Canada and the major churches in Canada. And then finally in 1885 we had what was known as the pass system. Have you ever heard of the pass system? Does anyone know what the pass system was? It was that the Indian agent in every one of these First Nations communities would have to sign an authorization for anybody living in those communities to leave, to sell their farm produce, to do almost anything off the land which they were living in, this restricted land we've called reserves. That pass system, which had no basis in law, but simply authorized by officials, went on for the next 60 years. We've only recently become aware or reminded that the pass system existed from coast to coast to coast as a way of suppressing and suffocating those who were the original peoples of this land. The stories that we hear now about Indian residential schools are even at this distance, because the last one closed more than 30 years ago, are hard for us to bear. But one thing is clear. Now that we are beginning to know, we cannot forget. Walking Wolf said a few minutes ago that we've heard the truth, but we haven't heard all the truth. We are still at the early stages of hearing so much more that we do not yet know about our own history. The chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Murray Sinclair, said, "It took us many decades to completely engulf First Nations people with past laws and Indian Acts and Indian residential schools. We are not going to reverse that overnight." And he also says, the reason that so many people who are First Nations or Métis or Inuit feel so helpless, so not worth something. As Carolyn said a few minutes ago, the reason that one's own self-worth is called into question is that when you read the history of this country, it's as if you are an original person, you don't exist. That was the story that was told to Indigenous people, and it was also the story that was told to all of us who didn't go to Indigenous schools, but we went to English or French or some other European-based school system, and we were told that this is so far in the past, so marginal to what this country is all about, that we should just totally forget it and ignore it. What has happened, though? What has happened is that the resilience of Indigenous people has overcome all of the things that were attempted on the part of big institutions, whether that be governments or churches. Some of you will remember, almost 10 years ago in 2007, on June the 11th, Prime Minister Stephen Harper stood up in the House of Commons at a special session in which in front of him sat the leaders of Indigenous people from the Assembly of First Nations, the Congress of Aboriginal Peoples, the Native Women's Associations, the Inuit, and said to them all, to our members of Parliament and to the country, we need to apologize. Not just because of the individual behavior of staff who abused and criminally offended little children, as we see here, but we need to apologize because the intention of Canadian governments from Confederation on was ultimately to kill the Indian in the child. Think of that. To kill the Indian in the child. How could that be the policy of any Canadian government or any person of faith who was Roman Catholic, Methodist, Presbyterian, Anglican, or anything else? As one historian wrote many years later, this was truly a national crime. And as in any criminal proceeding, we need to see it through to the point where justice must be seen to happen and will happen. As I have been thinking about this year and recalling the celebrations of 50 years ago in Centennial 1967, I've been thinking that we have, even more important than the 100th anniversary, an incredibly important task to realize what our true history is about and to set it right. As we meet in this church today, a group of Christian folks from Kitchener, Waterloo, and surrounding area are walking on a pilgrimage through Ontario to arrive later in May at the Parliament buildings in recognition of the need for all of us to act in solidarity, to move from the truth that we begin to know to genuine acts of apology and redress and retribution and, yes, reconciliation. This is tough work. You got some glimpse of that when Walking Wolf talked about what is still the situation today. Stan McKay, who was the moderator of our church, the first Cree moderator in the early 1990s, has said repeatedly in all the times I've heard him, the impact and the reality of residential schools is not just about our past, the last 150 plus years, it's about us today. It's what we need to do today. About a decade ago, the chief who spoke out about the abuse of residential schools is now the national chief. Phil Fontaine. Phil Fontaine phoned me one night in Ottawa and said, I want to have a conference. I want to bring people together. And the question will be, is reconciliation possible? Is it possible? Is it possible? When Daniel was speaking to the children and telling that wonderful story about who the land belongs to, it spoke to me of one of the truths that I've learned in the privilege I've had over the last two decades to walk with Indigenous leaders. And when they say, the land does not belong to us, we belong to the land. How contrary that is to centuries of European and North American civilization, which has so directed our minds and our hearts and our lives in another direction. It's like a massive wake-up call. A wake-up call, sort of as if we've been this long sleep and not even knowing or caring what's been happening, but maybe at a time when we absolutely need to hear this. As I drove here this morning, Michael Enright was interviewing a young Canadian woman who lives and works in Texas. Her name is Kathleen Hayhoe. He was talking to her about the challenge of dealing with climate crisis and climate change. And she said several things that were quite remarkable. She said, it's true, I live and work in Texas, but we are doing more here in Texas to get off the fatal addiction of fossil fuels and begin to draw on the never-ending benefit of the sun and the wind to create a new type of world and a new type of energy. Those are the truths that exist primarily in the original peoples who have been on this land for tens of thousands of years and have that, among other truths, to share with us. That, to me, is the essence of why reconciliation is important. Yes, it's important to recognize the hurt and to respond in a way that does produce real healing. Since I had the opportunity to sit with others and plan on what a Truth and Reconciliation Commission would look like, we wrestled with having three words in the title of the commission. We knew that the truth had to be told. We knew that reconciliation was absolutely critical. But more than that, without healing, it would be a hollow accomplishment. Some of you may have noticed that I'm wearing a rather bright tie this morning. And just in case you wanted to know where that tie came from, it came from the person who has been one of the leaders of the healing movement for decades. He's a hereditary chief in British Columbia named Bobby Joseph. If you've ever heard of Reconciliation Canada, which grew out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Bobby is the leader of that. And I met Bobby one day at a First Nations meeting, and he was wearing this tie. I was wearing a kind of funky tie that I had picked up in the Maritimes. And he said, I really like your tie. Can I have your tie? I said, absolutely, but I want your tie. And that, to me, spoke of a kind of mutuality of respect and allyship that is critical to the healing and reconciliation movement that we all need today. When Phil Fontaine asked me whether I would speak in Calgary at this conference on Is Reconciliation Possible? He gave me an impossible title for my talk. He said, I want you to talk about the damage that's been done to the churches by residential schools. I was speechless. The damage that was done to the churches? I thought it was the damage that was done to these seven generations of Indigenous children from all over Canada. He said, yes, that's true, but how has this hurt you? How has it hurt the people you have spent the greater part of your life worshiping and sharing this country with? And that has set off in my mind and in my heart the realization, just as Murray Sinclair has said repeatedly, what we are dealing with in truth and reconciliation is not an Aboriginal issue, it's a Canadian issue. One final story. A few years back, Ovid Mercredi, a well-known former national chief, came to my hometown, Charlottetown, for a visit. He said, I want to come and stay with you for a few days. I said, great. But I said, Ovid, if you're going to come, you're going to have to speak, because people want to hear what you've got to say. Well, I could do that, I guess, he said. I said, I'll have you speak to the Rotary Club in Charlottetown. Great, he said. I even know what my topic will be. I said, okay. What's your topic going to be? He said, I want to talk about perfecting Canada. I said, perfecting Canada? What could you be possibly talking about? He said, didn't you people have a big meeting here in 1864? The Fathers of Confederation? He said, who was missing at that meeting? Well, there were no Mothers of Confederation. That's half the population. And he said, from my point of view, nobody was there from my people either. And that's what he told the Rotary Club 3 years ago in Charlottetown. We need, as we come to the 150th memorial celebration, overcome what was missing in the original conversations and dreams and hopes of over 150 years ago. So the question for each one of us this morning is, how will we, with the truth we now know and the truth we yet need, perfect Canada and move together on a true journey of healing and reconciliation? McGwich.
So this song that I'm going to sing, it's a two-parter. So the first part is a cappella. It's called Kayas, which is a Niska morning song, and I sing it for the missing and murdered.